Okay, so let's start our afternoon session. Our first speaker is going to be Heather Ahrens from the DNR. She informed me just before the talk that there's an error in her bio and she's working on her master's at UMD. So hopefully, I'm sure she's hoping she's going to finish that up soon. And she's going to talk to us today on statewide trends impacting aggregate resource availability.
My name's Heather Ahrens, and I've been working with the DNR for about 12 years on aggregate resource issues and aggregate mapping. And, you know, I with this talk, I kind of plan to put it in perspective with other mining activities, as well as talking from more of a social license to mine, which is kind of an ambiguous trend within mining regulators, landowners, interest groups about concepts and feelings of mining and some of the roles that we play in dealing with talking to the public. So, you know, I talk about aggregate, but a lot of times we use this interchangeably between sand and gravel operations and crushed stone operations. The impact of these mining activities can be different. There's a general rule of thumb that quarries are longer lived than sand and gravel, but overall, that's one of the main impasses that people think about when planning and zoning for sand and gravel versus bedrock is just some of the general impacts of dewatering for a quarry. There are some dewatering operations for sand and gravel, and aquifer issues associated to the activity. To put it into perspective of other resources that we use, sand and gravel is actually the largest non-mineral industry in the world, both in value and volume. If you look at how we use all of the minerals in the course of our life, we use a lot of sand and gravel. Unlike the other resources that we use, most of the sand and gravel that we use is produced locally and is dominated by local and more regional markets instead of global markets. In Minnesota, we produce it in every county. And unlike other mining activities in the state, sand and gravel is regulated at the county and sometimes even the township level. So there's a patchwork of regulations involved with sand and gravel mining. Of course, there are some state permitting water appropriations, as well as, you know, PCA, noise, dust, stormwater. But the LGU for sand and gravel mining is counties, sometimes townships. So just an overview, what the aggregate resource mapping program at the DNR, what we do, some statewide trends with sustainability, and just assessing some of the risks in terms of scale and social license, and to try to put this into context to people who are near gravel pits, what is long-term and what is short-term impacts. So for mapping, we look at sediment landform associations. And there are a lot of different maps that we use. For example, we use soils maps, which capture the first 5 feet of information. The second, we use superficial maps, which capture the first lithostratigraphic unit. But sometimes we want to go below that. And so that's why we look at both the landform, the sediment, and what we're encountering in those features. Our main data and our main product is digital data. We put everything that we try to gather into databases that are in both GIS, and we have field observations, gravel pits. We survey all the gravel pits in the county, and all of our data is available for download. We do produce maps as well, but I would say most of our information that we give out is in the form of data, and it's been accumulating quite a bit over the last 11 years. So we've overall have over 11,000 field observation points that we've accumulated, and over 5,000 gravel pits that we've surveyed. We display our information with an interactive web-based application. We call it Aggregate Mapper. So that people without access to GIS can get to our main product, which is a lot of databases. So people can click on a gravel pit and see if it's a large gravel pit, a small gravel pit. We put it into association with a county well index. And then we also put our resource information. The dark colors are high potential for sand and gravel. The lighter colors are lower potential for sand and gravel. What I like about doing it in this way and allowing people zoom into their house and see what where sand and gravel is, it also provides transparency in information. It provides, lets them know what information we were using to make our observations and interpretations. It also lets them know where we don't have information. So if there's a person who knows that there's a gravel deposit in the middle of a forested plot that has no data associated to it, you know, obvious data gaps show up. This is the current status. We are we had nearly four counties that are in progress, and we have 17 completed. The reason that our program was started, and it was started back in 84 with a Minnesota statute, 8494, was because approximately 50% of sand and gravel or aggregate is consumed in funded in publicly funded projects. So in areas like Lyon County, that actually can reach 85% of sand and gravel is being paid for by taxpayer money. And where that's going is roads, sewer systems, you know, schools, public buildings. That's that 50%. The other 50% is residential construction and commercial construction. But the issue with sand and gravel products and is that they have a lifespan. And us being in the northern United States and dealing with freeze-thaw climates are very much aware that, you know, our roads need ongoing maintenance. So sand and most of the roads that are we're sand and gravel going towards roads is mostly going towards maintenance. We haven't had large expanses of our infrastructure since the 1960s. Despite short-term trends and short-term, you know, dives in the market, there's an that it, sand and gravel continues to grow the demand for it over the long term. So, and this is a very conservative estimate, and this is based off of information from the USGS. Though one thing that's important to get to counties is, and to talk to land planners is that the distribution of sand and gravel isn't evenly distributed. And as geologists, we know that. And that there's natural areas of scarcity. For example, the Red River Valley is a lot of clay with just some minimal sand and gravel, but great sand and gravel where there is, but minimal sand and gravel deposits. So we're dealing with uneven distribution, natural scarcity, and also an uneven distribution with quality. Sand and gravel quality depends on glaciers and bedrock. So depending on different bedrock units and where glaciers flowed, you have, for example, in the green, areas that have high shale. And MnDOT actually put this together, and that translates into where they're seeing problems with their pavements. And shale and decracking carbonates cause potholes and long cracks in the pavement. Iron oxides can cause aesthetic issues like staining, but and also potholes. Another issue causing scarcity areas is that we're just using our permitted supplies. This is a gravel pit near Carlton, Minnesota, off of I-35. And that's a minivan for scale. You're seeing that they're starting to slope and reclaim this edge so that these deposits that we've been using for a long time are starting to deplete. And it will need a new generation of aggregate mines. Another trend that we're seeing is that in the next 30 years, Minnesota is going to see more people. If you break down our consumption, in 2000 it was 10.5 tons per person for a year. At the heyday in 2006 of residential construction, that increased to 14 tons per person per year. So not only are we going to continue to consume, you know, somewhere in between that, but 1.3 million people are going to consume that as well. One of the next trends that we're also seeing is land use that precludes mining. With the new tax money that has occurred, we're not sure how much money is going to go into acquisition and easements of conservation land. This is one example of Forest Legacy in Minnesota. Their conservation goal is 828 square miles, which equals approximately the size of Candy, Ohio County. So what's going to happen, you know, as a result, an indirect outcome is that there's going to be large expanses of land that can't be used for aggregate mining. And a lot of various groups are buying land or buying easements. And easements are where a landowner might sell the easement and get maybe a cash payment, but that land use designation might carry through for a certain years, or might be forever. So there are permanent land use restrictions sometimes involved. Now, working for the DNR, and I know you guys toured the Minnesota River Valley, there's obvious benefits for having land use or land conservation easements. And one of them is loss of soil reduction. There's increased water quality. There's increased habitat. But as I said, one of the unintended outcomes is that we are removing aggregate sources. An interesting thing, and I ran a case study in Meeker County where are conservation easements occurring and where is residential development occurring in rural landscapes. And you'll see that there's an overlap between sand and gravel and easements. In red, you have the highest priority for duck habitat, and in blue it's low priority, and that's kind of your agricultural fields. When you overlap where sand and gravel is located, and that's what all these little dots are, this is from a database from MnDOT, you'll see that there's an overlap with historic aggregate deposits. That makes sense. You know, if a farmer is going to subdivide his land or potentially give up his land for an easement, it's going to be low-producing agricultural land. So, looking at it in terms of where this is most likely, it makes sense that low-producing agricultural land is going to be in supply. The bottom line for aggregate sustainability is having a local supply. And the reason that is because of the hauling costs, the amount of money that it's going to take to potentially transport it 10 miles, 20 miles, or 40 miles. You know, loading that initial truck up to go just a little bit off the site costs $7 to $8. But as soon as you start transporting it, that price starts to increase, and that's what we call the delivered cost. So there's just like buying your produce locally, there's a benefit to buying sand and gravel locally. It lowers the cost of transportation, which means that tax dollars go further. It reduces a community's carbon footprint, and it decreases the wear and tear on the infrastructure. So when you look at how to plan for our future supply, and knowing that sand and gravel is a locally regulated resource, there is a governance that involves numerous entities and decisions. And it's very much like watersheds, where a few people in a watershed can potentially impact the water quality for people downstream. It's the same thing for sand and gravel. There could be a regionally viable and important resource that could affect, you know, large metropolitan areas, but are being decided on a more local scale. Right now, we have our current supply, which is being depleted. And then there's development of new permitted resources. And it requires a landowner with a deposit, a willing mining company, local government approval, so public notices, zoning planning, input from neighbors, and input from interest groups. And this is where the social license to mine comes in. And there's people come in with initial opinions about mining in general, and they're worried about the impacts. Most likely, they're worried about the impacts to their well, and if they live close by, they're worried about, you know, noisy trucks and dust. And a lot of times, this is where we'll come in and talk to a community just to give them context to why sand and gravel is being mined there. Sometimes it can't be mined somewhere else. You know, sometimes that's the only deposit that might be in their community, and that this is a community benefit. But it's not necessarily meant to change any minds, but it's just information and context that people can have as they make land use decisions. So, you know, sand and gravel mining above the water table is probably the lower tech of all the permutations of mining. You know, it could be just using a backhoe with a grader and a truck. And it could be I've seen it as a one-man show where the guy gets out, put in the truck, and then hops into the truck and then goes out the mine. So, you know, on a business level, a lot of times this is your mom-and-pop operation. As you start mining into the water table, and as you start mining, you know, deep expanses in the water table, it becomes a little bit more technical. And this is an example where it's just a backhoe going into the water table. But the more equipment you have or the bigger equipment you're using, that's a signal that this is a big deposit. You know, it's an economical deposit, but it's also a deposit that has regional importance. So our sand and gravel, our crushed stone mining, this is the largest aggregate quarry in Minnesota. It's in St. Paul or St. Cloud. Those are trucks for scale. And, you know, aggregate is finite. And even though there's bedrock and maybe bedrock might not be, you know, is infinite, but when you consider the footprint of the mine, how deep you can go, and what the surrounding land use is, bedrock does become a finite resource. So, risks, impacts, and reclamation. The scale, like I said, that large, high-quality deposits near markets are important resources. There's public benefits to sand and gravel mining. They're producing public supplies for our infrastructure. What are the environmental impacts of not mining at a site? You know, if a sand and gravel deposit isn't being mined, where is that resource going to come from? Is it going to be traveled farther? What is the carbon footprint for that activity? And are you disrupting a lot of little sites, or are you disrupting an equally and big site? Deeper mines versus wider mines in communities and townships, they might enact an ordinance not to mine below the water table, but there's an environmental impact to that. Instead of going down and extracting all of the resource, you're going wide and extracting some of the resource. So what is the best management practice for excavating for that community? If they have a lot of sand and gravel, that might be a viable option. But if there's a limited supply of sand and gravel, it might be better to go into the water table. aggregate mining and land use. You know, residential development is one of the biggest reasons why we have limited aggregate supplies in the Twin Cities. That scarcity areas are growing because of land use decisions. There was a study in 2000 by MGS that calculated our natural supply to be over 200 million cubic yards, I think. But because of land use and depletion, that has been reduced by 90%. Now, deposits like Empire Township and Umore are going to supplement and maybe extend the time frame where we are going to enter into a depletion for the southern metro area. But the northern metro area, being bounded by the Anoka Sand Plain and Glacial Lake Grantsburg, that's a natural scarcity area. So they're going to have to go north of those geologic areas and look for sand and gravel. I'm going to head back. Aggregate is a finite resource, but aggregate mining, as well as mining in general, is a temporary land use. Most of the new mines that I'm seeing, even larger ones, are 20-year, 25-year, which to people seem like a long time. But if you consider that Minnesota at one point was logged, and some of these logged areas are now starting to be considered old growth, it's just, and as geologists, we can understand longer time frames. So, you know, what is short term and what is long term is important to define and important to communicate. So that Empire Township is a great example of their vision in trying to, you know, foresee what they want their land to be like when mining is done. And so it's a great mixture of parkland, of wildlife land, of habitat, as well as residential development. So I always end a couple pictures on reclamation, and this is one reclamation of a very simple reclamation plan of just sloping, returning the topsoil and turning it back to agricultural land. And as I say that, over time, landscapes do recover if you give them the time. Here is a park in Meeker County, and hiking to it, you'd be surprised that there was ever a gravel pit there. When we map gravel pits, we identify if they're being passively reclaimed or just grown over or actively reclaimed. I actually think this one is passively reclaimed, but some areas need active reclamation to make sure that invasive species don't come in. And with that, I think I will open it up to questions or comments.
Any questions for Heather?
You're making it easy. Oh, great.
You mentioned about mining for the water table. That would be a local decision, then, right?
That's a local decision. Mm-hmm. Or restrict it. And it's can be tough for some local communities to navigate through the technical side of mining operations. And so on township levels, you know, those can be difficult technical issues to decide for their community. Well, our maps are tools. We also have fact sheets and that people can download for fact sheets about aggregate mining. We try to warehouse other information from other sources like USGS. I think there's a comprehensive planning tool that outlines how to plan for aggregates. Currently, we are working with the Aggregate Ready Mix Association and talking about gravel mining districts and the benefits of having gravel mining districts. One of the reasons is that You know, you want gravel mining close to people because that's where the market is, but people don't necessarily want to be close to gravel mining. So it's interesting to see when communities are upset about gravel mining close by and when they're not. And if you go to Maple Grove, you will see nice houses and nice condominiums right next to huge stockpiles, and that city has never received a complaint about that activity. And it seems to me that it's about setting expectations. When a person has a home and all of a sudden a gravel mining operation comes in, they're less, you know, it's upsetting. But if they go into an area knowing that this is, you know, gravel mining activity is going to occur here maybe at some time, I think that eases that conflict.
Thanks, Heather.
Thank you.